Welcome to the Extension Connection Podcast. The Grant County Cooperative Extension Service is here to help connect you with research-based information about economic development, energy and water, farm and ranch, yard and garden, natural resources, health and well-being, and our very popular youth development program, 4-H. I'm your host, Jessica, the 4-H and Ag Agent in Grant County, New Mexico. We are a part of New Mexico State University's College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Science, and we are here to provide you with reliable, research-based information and education. I'm finally back. I'm finally getting to release a podcast episode that actually I have had sitting in kind of a holding pattern for several months. I apologize, everyone. It is so hard to put out content on a regular basis with the type of job that I have, just being all the things to all the people all the time takes up a lot of time. Anyway, but I'm excited to go ahead and release this episode. I think you're going to find it really, really informational. I know I did. I learned a lot. And hopefully I can start making this more of a regular thing, putting out more content, more episodes. However, I'm always looking for ideas on things I can use for episodes. If you know somebody I should talk to, or a topic you'd like me to cover, please let me know. You can reach me at Jessie J, which is J-E-S-S-I-E-J, at NMSU, as in New Mexico State University, .edu, with those ideas. I hope you enjoy. So I have with me Dr. Wenzel. He is the NMSU Extension Veterinarian there at NMSU, and he has an absolutely incredible presentation that he just gave recently, and I thought that it would be excellent to make a podcast episode out of it. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, Jessica, and thank you for the invitation. So today what we're going to do is just have a little bit of a discussion about antimicrobial usage in livestock operations of all kinds, but kind of concentrate a little bit on cow-calf operations. And the reason we're going to have this discussion is basically a phenomenon that in the last several years has become a little more prominent, called antimicrobial resistance. It's been concerning to the human health world for a while, and so the Food and Drug Administration has kind of enacted some guidance for industries and stuff like that, and some rules have changed. It's basically, all of this is focused on trying to improve, make sure that when we use antimicrobials in the livestock world, especially for food animals, that we're being judicious about how we use those things. And so most livestock producers have been really conscious of using antimicrobials in their operations and have been careful. And so what is happening, though, is that the human medicine has deemed some of these antimicrobials that we use to be a little more important in human medicine than previously thought, and therefore they want to make sure that judicious use preserves the opportunities for those particular pharmaceuticals to be effective in human medicine for a long time to come.
And so we're talking about the use of antibiotics.
That's correct.
Basically.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and I use the term and I say antimicrobials because antibiotics are a naturally occurring compound that is found in nature that inhibits bacterial growth, and this is ever since time began that's been true. But with technology today, we have also synthesized some of those, or it may be even changed some of those antibiotics that we used to find in in nature. And so the term antibiotic really means a naturally occurring compound, but antimicrobial includes the synthetic compounds as well.
Okay.
That have antibacterial properties. And so that's really what we're trying to talk about is being careful with the antibiotics and antimicrobials that we use to make sure that there is that we are always judicious about their use. And then there was a FDA guideline put out. It's called a Guidance for Industry, and number 263, Guidance for Industry 263, that becomes effective in June of 2023, requires that all antimicrobials given to livestock by any route come under veterinary oversight. And so that's going to change things. What that means is that it will no longer be feasible to go to a feed store or animal health supply store and purchase antibiotics and some antimicrobials without a veterinary prescription. Mm-hmm. So in June, that will go away. So the term over-the-counter antibiotics will go away because that will no longer be possible. Mm-hmm. So all antibiotics and most antimicrobials that are used will fall under veterinary oversight. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's important that we are careful and do these things.
Yeah, I was just thinking that is kind of a... It is kind of a good thing just because, you know, somebody just off the street can't walk into a store and just grab a bottle of antibiotics and they don't really know what they're treating, for one. They just know their animal's sick and so they're hitting it with some antibiotics or antimicrobials. These treatments are used in a better way.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, and it used to be that going to a feed store or an animal health supply store and purchasing an antibiotic, say, to give to a cow that's sick or a pig or sheep or whatever. I mean, that was pretty common. And you know, it's not that people do things intentionally wrong. It's just that historically, they may not have had enough training to understand exactly the indications for using these different products. And so now what is going to be required is that they consult with a veterinarian before they can do that stuff. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. Because basically, we had quite a few drugs and antimicrobials, antibiotics that have been prescription for a long period of time. And especially with newer technology type drugs, they have all been prescriptions specifically because we have to guard and target the use more correctly. And I think as we learn as livestock producers to be more targeted with our therapy, we become more effective in treating illnesses and making sure that we're using the right medication at the right time in the right way so that we maximize its effects, which is really what judicious antimicrobial use is, and that's mm-hmm. what we're trying to shoot for.
Yeah.
And so the over-the-counter products, there are still some that will be over-the-counter, but anything that has been deemed as medically important falls under the guidelines of now prescription use, and I think that's really beneficial for what we want to do. And so the cornerstone of all of this is what's called a veterinary client patient relationship. And that is a legal definition. It's been present for many, many years. The American Veterinary Medical Association defines a valid veterinary client-patient relationship when certain conditions exist. Those conditions are, number one, the veterinarian assumes responsibility for making medical judgments and the need for treatment, and the client agrees to follow the instructions of the veterinarian, which is pretty typical. I mean, we all fall under that most of the time. Number two is that there is sufficient knowledge of the animals by the veterinarian to initiate at least a general or preliminary diagnosis. But that requires that the veterinarian is either seen personally the sick animal or is familiar and acquainted with the keeping and care of the animals. And in New Mexico, our veterinary board has defined that as being present on the facility at least once a year. And so a lot of times we develop a relationship with our local veterinarian where we can call them up and ask for advice, and that's okay. That's falls under a valid veterinary client-patient relationship. The third requirement for that is that the veterinarian has to be available for follow-up in case of an adverse reaction or a failure therapy. And so those conditions are the minimum conditions that are required for a valid veterinary client patient relationship. That has to exist for a veterinarian to be able to write a prescription. And so for now, can a producer still go to the feed store and buy a bottle of, say, LA-200? The answer is yes, but it will require that they have a prescription from their veterinarian that allows the purchase of that drug, and the feed store or the animal health supply store now has the responsibility of additional paperwork to keep track and record those prescriptions when somebody comes in and purchases a drug. So it's really, in the long run, it's trying to use the therapies correctly. And one of the points about that is there's two different ways we use drugs. One is called labeled drug use, and that's whenever we use a medication exactly as it's stated on the label. That falls under the guise of labeled drug use. And that means that we cannot vary in any manner from what the label says. That includes species, indications, dose, route, timing. All of that stuff is on the label, and it is required by law to use it exactly as it's stated on the label. We cannot vary from that. So if we do end up varying from that, that's what's called extra-label drug use. And extra-label drug use requires additional liabilities and additional paperwork. So to use a drug or any medication in a way that varies from that label in any form or manner requires a prescription from your veterinarian under a valid veterinary client-patient relationship, and then carries additional labeling requirements, such as the withdrawal time. Because if we use a drug as directed on label, there is a withdrawal time that must be met. Withdrawal time meaning the time from which a medication is given until that animal can either be harvested for meat or milk used for human consumption. And so those withdrawal times have to be met exactly. But when we use a drug extra label, it increases the withdrawal time. And so the veterinarian that prescribes that has to make the purchaser aware of what the additional withdrawal time would be.
And is it usually they double that withdrawal time?
It really varies. It depends on the drug. Some drugs are metabolized pretty quickly, so it would only add a short period of time. But a lot of times we study these, and pharmaceutical companies, they study these drugs, and the withdrawal time means that in a healthy animal, that everything is cleared to a level that is considered tolerant for that particular medication. It may not be zero, but at least the Food and Drug Administration has developed tolerance levels for every pharmaceutical that we use in the livestock industry, especially in food animals. And that tolerance, in some cases, it is zero. There is no tolerance for any level of that drug to be present in an animal system. But most of the pharmaceuticals have a level that is considered, there is a tolerance level of some that once it reaches that tolerance level or below, then it is considered safe for human consumption. And generally those tolerances are in parts per billion. Mm-hmm. So it's a really minuscule amount anyway. And so with that and the understanding what a withdrawal time is one of the things that is required that we make sure we communicate to anybody that's using the antimicrobials that or antibiotics that we have prescribed for them is to make sure that they understand that there's an additional withdrawal time that we need to be conscious of.
Right.
So there are some other guidance for industries that were used to help develop this where we're at now. There's guidance number 209 that had some recommended principles, and basically it was about what drugs are medically important. And there are some guidelines that went forth, and it's that we use medically important antimicrobial drugs in food-producing animals should be limited to those uses that are considered necessary for assuring animal health. So basically, we can use these antimicrobials in both control and prevention, but also treatment. And those are the three indications that we can use them for, is for treating a sick animal or in preventative measures that or control measures that will help prevent the disease. And so because of that, medically important antimicrobial drugs means that because they are deemed medically important, and there was a group, World Health Organization, and a lot were involved in outlining which of these drugs are really important. And that's why there's been the inclusion of veterinary oversight with those. You know, and I think a lot of it has to do with what's on the label. Producers, a lot of times we've used and become comfortable with using these drugs, and a lot of times we don't take the time anymore to really pay attention to the labels. And of course, pharmaceutical companies have invested a lot of money in producing these labels and making sure that all the information is correct on it, and that costs them a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so all that is needed is on a label. We have to make sure that we read those labels, because there's a lot of information on there that we don't pay as much attention to as we should. And we should. In using these drugs judiciously, it requires that we look at those labels and are familiar with them.
Mm-hmm. It's just like whenever you get medicine from the store, should probably read how much of that to take.
Well, you know, and the other thing is that when we go to a pharmacy and we pick up medications for ourselves, there's a ton of paperwork that's attached to that. And what do we do with it? We don't pay much attention to it.
Right.
And we should.
We really should.
Because everything on there, there's a reason it's there. And it's mm-hmm. important that we read those labels and understand the drugs that we're using. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. even in our own personal lives, we should be better about reading the labels and reading the paperwork that comes with it, because it can be very important. You know, there's some medications that we use, and even in the livestock industry, that are hazardous to the people that are actually administering the medications. And so that information is on the label, but it's something that you should probably be aware of. For mm-hmm. instance, one of the drugs that we use very commonly in synchronizing cattle to help them and trying to group reproductive efforts is a drug called luteolase, which is a drug that helps us manipulate the cycle in cattle. But it is rapidly absorbed through human skin, and it can affect a woman the same way it does a cow. So that's always a concern. But also, if you're asthmatic and you splash that on you, it can create a fatal asthmatic attack, because it's a potent bronchoconstrictor. And so medications like that, you need to be aware of the health risks to yourself when you're using those. And all that's on the label, and generally speaking, the veterinarians will advise you to be cautious with this. This is something that maybe you want to wear gloves with and all that, so that if you do get some on your hands, you're not putting yourself at risk. Mm-hmm. And so labels are really important. And generally speaking, the labels have a lot of information, and it spells out exactly what the medication is used for. And so, like, for instance, there's labels for medications, antimicrobials or antibiotics that we use, say, for the treatment of respiratory disease in cattle. And there's generally four organisms that can contribute to that most of the time, and this drug is indicated for the treatment of bovine respiratory disease that's associated, and then it lists the four bugs that it's indicated for, and then any other conditions that it can treat, and then it talks about dosage and route and how you give it and where you give it. For instance, I'm just pulled a label up for a medication called Draxxin, which is fairly commonly used. And it talks about how it has to be injected subcutaneously as a single dose in the neck at a dosage of 2.5 milligrams per kilogram, or 1.1 milliliters per 100 pounds body weight. And then the additional instruction of do not inject more than 10 cc's per injection site. And so, and then it has the other standard warnings for use in animals only, not for human use, keep out of reach of children, not for use in chickens or turkeys. And the reason all that is there is because of what they have studied the risks for in the animals that it's indicated for. And Draxxin has a particular residue warning on it, because it has a drug withdrawal time of 18 days from the last treatment, but it's not approved for use in female dairy cattle that are lactating, and therefore it cannot be used. in lactating dairy cattle. So only in
and that would be cattle. And that would be against the law.
That is correct. So the thing of it is that if we don't use them exactly as it states on the label, it is prohibited by law to do that. To vary. And a lot of people don't understand that. They don't think it's as big a deal as it is. And it is. It's a it's against the law to use a drug in a manner other than what the label states, or under direction of a veterinarian, you can use an extra label the same way. And so all of this was based on a guidance for industry, FDA's guidance for industry number 152, which outlines and classifies a bunch of antimicrobial drugs, and mostly antibiotics, but some antimicrobials, the synthetics, as either critically important, highly important, or important. And then they group those particular drugs based upon their class and their mechanism of action and how important they are to human medicine. And so, for instance, the critically important drugs are in a group called fluoroquinolones, and livestock producers are pretty familiar with these drugs. Baytrol, Avicen, we have the group that are called macrolides, which are Tylan, Mycotyl, Draxin, Zactrin, and Zuprivo. We have what are called third-generation cephalosporins, such as Naxil, Exenil, and Exceed, and then the potentiated sulfas. And so those particular drugs are in the class of critically important. And that means that we have to be extremely careful how we use those drugs. And then the WHO also identified as highly important the classes of antimicrobials under the penicillins, the aminopenicillins, which I realize that most folks listening don't understand what all that is, but you don't really need to. Your veterinarian does. And it's your veterinarian that's going to be guiding you with this.
That's why they get paid the big bucks.
That's right. Yeah. And that's why we invested so much to go to school, is to learn all that stuff.
That's right.
And so mostly with those drugs, we understand where they are classed depends on the mechanism of action and how they work against the bacteria that they're used for. And so whenever we have an infection, generally speaking, it's never one bug. It's usually a mix of bugs that are causing our problems. And so the idea is that we need to choose the appropriate antimicrobial or antibiotic based upon what we think is going to be the predominant disease-causing bacteria in that particular infection. And then what we want to do is use the drug that is the most effective taking care of that particular infection. So that's the idea behind it. What we're trying to do, that's part of judicious use, is to make sure that we're using the absolute best choice in every condition and in every case. Sometimes we may not choose correctly, and sometimes we get laboratory help to figure out which one is the best to use in this particular case. And of course, when we do that, we have to understand that there's some problems associated with that. But generally speaking, if we have laboratory support of our decision-making process, it's generally very beneficial for us. We know we're using the drugs correctly.
Mm-hmm. And that's so we're not just grabbing whatever's available. Yep. We got this on the shelf. Got to just use this.
Yep. Or, you know, we should never choose the antimicrobial because it's cheap. Mm. It's not about that. It's about what's the most effective for the causative agent that we suspect is causing the disease.
I would imagine if you were to grab, you know, something that was not the correct medication to use, it's not gonna be effective. It's not gonna be as effective, and then you're still gonna have some problems potentially, and then you have to go different routes, and essentially just because that one that you chose was cheaper really doesn't pay off in the end, because you end up having to dose several different times. And
right. And the other thing about that is that when you choose something just because it's cheap, if it's not effective against the infection that's being caused, then we're several days later down the road in the disease process. And of course, especially when we talk about food animals, our whole goal is to get a cure as quickly as possible, the most complete cure we can. Because what we want to do is make sure that the product that we produce is of the highest quality. And so the quicker we relieve whatever condition it is, the quicker they can return to normal growth, which means that our product is going to be of better quality than one that has a prolonged illness. And so the idea is fix them and fix them as quickly as possible. And so that's really kind of the idea behind a lot of this, is to try to make sure that what we are doing is making sure that we do the best job on every single case that we can. Mm-hmm. And as we move forward with this, and especially because of the importance to human medicine, we do have some other additional rules with this. For instance, like in the group that are considered critically important, there's a group called the fluoroquinolones, the Baytril and Avacin and those types of drugs, where even a veterinarian cannot prescribe them as extra label. It has to be used exactly as the label states. Now, we do have a critically important group called the macrolides, which is pretty common, Tylan and Draxin and Micotyl, and that group, a veterinarian can prescribe extra label drug use. So it's not just simply because they are critically important that either we have to use them exactly as the label or we can vary from the label. It depends on their mechanism of action. And so the veterinarian will be able to have some flexibility with some of the different classes of drugs, but not with all of them. The cephalosporins, Naxil, Exceed, Exenil, which are pretty commonly used, they are deemed critically important, but they are also another group that extra label drug use is prohibited, which means we have no leeway in how we use that medication, even a veterinarian. So we can't prescribe it, we can't use them extra label. And so it's really important to understand that, because we have to know which drugs can we vary from and which drugs should we not vary from. In the highly important classes, the penicillins, the aminopenicillins, all of those, most of them can be used extra label, as long as there's a valid veterinary client patient relationship and the veterinarian prescribes it. So one of the things that comes into play with this is also what's called the Veterinary Feed Directive, which came into play in 2017, which means that there is times, especially in disease prevention, that we have to make sure that the feed, sometimes we will include some medicated feed, some antibiotics in feed to prevent disease, say respiratory disease, in cattle that are deemed high risk, or say in fresh weaned calves or something like that, to help prevent respiratory disease. But to do that now, there is what's called a VFD order, Veterinary Feed Directive order, that the veterinarian must issue ahead of time before you can purchase the feed that contains the antibiotics. And basically what that means is that the VFD is a prescription for a feed additive type food that has an antibiotic in it. And so all of that is something that your veterinarian is familiar with and needs to take care of. So the VFD, and so most of the time what that means is that to be able to purchase a feed stuff that has an antibiotic in it, it's not difficult. It just requires additional paperwork and additional record keeping. And there's a couple of time limitations on them. Like, for instance, what the expiration date of the VFD order is, whatever is dictated by the drug. And then you have to use it exactly as the label says. So there's a duration of use where how you use the drug. So most of that just means that if you're considering using that particular technology, just get with your veterinarian a little ahead of time so that you have adequate time to complete the paperwork process mm-hmm. that's required for using it mm-hmm. like that. So, and the whole summary of making sure that we are careful and judicious is that if we don't show judicious now and accountable use of antimicrobials now, then we may not be able to use them for prevention and control in the future. And so it's really our responsibility to use these as carefully and as judiciously as possible so that we can use them into the future. Mm-hmm. And it's the right thing to do. You know, we all are concerned about, both in human medicine and in veterinary medicine, about antimicrobial resistance and bugs that don't work or don't die as well as they used to and all of that. And so it's the responsibility falls on all of us to make sure that we do everything we can to minimize the the movement of antimicrobial resistance. And that's really what it's about. So mm-hmm. I think the biggest thing that we can learn from today is that this veterinary client-patient relationship, it's not just a legal requirement, it's important. And understanding that we have a limited number of veterinarians that work on food animal species anymore, especially out in the country in more rural areas. And so it may take a little more work for you to find a veterinarian that is willing to work with you and do the things that are necessary to make sure that you develop this valid veterinary client-patient relationship moving into the future.
So I have a couple questions for you. So we hear a lot about, if you go to the grocery store, I'll put it this way. You can go to the meat section and you're going to see things that are labeled, you know, antibiotic free, all those types of things, which in reality, they should all be antibiotic free.
Yes, that is correct. Any meat that's in a meat case has been tested. All the carcasses are tested for the presence of antibiotic residues. That's part of our food safety inspection service. And they do a fantastic job. It's amazing the job that they do. We have the safest, most wholesome food supply in the world. And especially when it comes to meat, beef, pork, chicken, all of that is very scrutinized to make sure that there is not a presence of an antibiotic in any of it. So every piece of meat in a meat case is antibiotic free. Okay. Now, so part of this antibiotic free movement and all that is it sounds good. I mean, it sounds noble, I guess you would say. Mm-hmm. But in reality, in trying to improve efficiency and raising more pounds of meat off of less animals, we do have to use some technologies that include feeding antibiotics to prevent certain diseases and all that. And so, but the thing of it is that even though we include those technologies, which actually increase our efficiency in production, even those animals still, we don't have to worry about antibiotics being present in the meat because they're not there. Or if they're present, it's in a level that the Food and Drug Administration has a tolerance for. And so every carcass is tested for the presence of antibiotics. And so we know that if the meat in the meat case is absolutely fine, mm-hmm. that there is no concern of antibiotics being present in those. Even though the label may not say it,
right,
doesn't say antibiotic free, mm-hmm. we know that every piece of meat has to meet those requirements. And so every piece of meat in the meat case is okay.
Mm-hmm. And what would happen if, let's just say, they did find an antibiotic residue that was over that level? Right. What would happen? What happens?
So what happens in the inspection process, every carcass is tested for the presence of antibiotics. And what happens if they do pick up any kind of a hint or a positive test, then that carcass is moved to a different cage. It moves to a chain to where that carcass is isolated and further testing has occurred. Because there has been cases, for instance, where an animal had a physical condition that prevented them from clearing the antibiotic, even though the producer did everything they were supposed to do. And I am familiar with a particular case where there was a drug residue in a cow that was sent to slaughter. But in that particular case, she had an inactive kidney, and that antibiotic had been sitting in the kidney her whole life. It never left her body. It was sitting in a kidney. Now, was it in tissue? Well, not much, but they did pick up that there was the presence of an antibiotic actually in her kidney. And so they moved that carcass to the isolation area, and then they did further testing, and when they did the further testing, they found that it was sitting in her kidney. But luckily, the paperwork of the producer showed that he had done everything correctly, had observed the withdrawals, and that prompted them to do further work, or what's called histopathology, And that's when they found out that the kidney was actually inactive. So there are cases where that can occur. But our Food Safety and Inspection Service is so thorough that in reality, the chances of a carcass slipping by are basically none. Because everything is scrutinized.
Right, right.
And so if an antibiotic is picked up, they are isolated, pulled right off the chain directly, put into a different system in a different cage, and held there until all the testing can be completed.
That is so good to know.
Our food inspection service in the United States is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. It's just really remarkable, the job that they do. And it does, what it does is contribute to the safety and wholesomeness of the product that we can eat safely in this country.
Yes.
And we know that.
And we're lucky.
Yes, we are.
We're very blessed and very lucky because of that. So,
yep, it's just, cool. That's the saying goes, you know, people that are hungry have one concern, and that's where the next meal is coming from. But people that are not hungry, that have a safe and abundant supply of, an economical supply of food, they can start to wonder about other things.
Mm-hmm.
And we're lucky in this country that we have that luxury.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just I wanted to kind of ask that question because if you were to go, you know, on Google, Facebook, all of these places, you know, or even the store, you know, you kind of get the impression due to certain companies labeling certain products a certain way that, you know, this company invested in putting, you know, no antibiotics on their label, but this company didn't. So it must mean that this piece of meat does not have antibiotics and this one does, when in reality they're exactly the same.
Yes, that's correct. And so basically most of those, when they say antibiotic free, that just means they were raised without any feed additive antibiotics or something like that, which is fine. I mean, that's a marketing choice that some people make, and some people, you know, that's fine. Whatever they want to do, we mm-hmm. want to be able to supply that food to whatever the public desires are.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, there's very little difference amongst a lot of those. And so, for instance, if there is a piece of meat that does not say antibiotic-free, we know that it's still, we don't have to worry about it because if there, you know, it has been tested to make sure the presence of antibiotics are at a zero tolerance or below.
Cool.
And so that's a comfort.
Yes.
So the next, you know, that kind of to lead into that, there's also the question about hormones. Does my meat have hormone in it? Well, in reality, every piece of meat has hormone in it because hormones are a chemical messenger. And that's really what they are. They're produced in an organ someplace or a gland, and then they travel through fluids or blood supply or whatever, and they go somewhere else, and they are a messenger. They cause they have an effect that they cause based upon the tissue that they go to and all that. And so the term hormone at first makes you think, well, this could be bad, but really that's all they are, is a chemical messenger. There are groups of these chemical messengers or hormones that have specific uses and they're in certain classes. But basically, the question comes into where the concern about hormones is about growth-promoting implants. Does that cause a human health risk? And the answer is absolutely not. That's been studied for 50 years and by multiple scientific agencies, groups, all that stuff. And in reality, there are no health risks of that technology that's employed in, especially in the beef industry. We use a lot of growth implants. And the reason we use them is that it helps products to grow, it helps cattle to grow faster, these products do, by increasing their ability to gain. But also, it's a great thing from an ecological standpoint because it decreases the number of inputs that are required. So cattle can produce more, we can produce more meat with less cattle, less feed, less water, than conventionally if we didn't use those technologies. And so what's happened over the last 50 years of using this technology is that we've produced way more meat with way less cattle and on way less land, and we still are feeding the world. And that's an important part of it, because not everybody has the luxury of choosing a particular type of meat that, say, is organic, organically raised, and never used any of these different types of technologies and all that. And obviously that production method costs a little bit more money, and that's fine. We want people to have that choice. But some people have to go to the meat case and make a choice based on economics. Mm-hmm. And what we want to do, because red meat is such a huge part of our diet because of the quality and the health benefits that red meat has, is that we want to make that affordable and available. And to do that, it requires that we employ some technologies. And so one of the things that people don't understand is that these hormones, the steroid hormones especially, are used in cattle in these implants that give them an additional change in their metabolism, so to speak, that helps them be a little more efficient. It takes less feed to put on to make more meat. And that's always a good thing from an environmental standpoint, from a sustainability standpoint. Mm-hmm. This technology is one of the greatest technologies that we've ever had for raising beef.
Yeah, this is a game changer.
It always has been. It's made it to where we can produce meat economically at a rate greater than what we could without this technology, mm-hmm. which is benefits everybody. So the biggest thing is that why do we use them? And it's because of the way they influence protein synthesis. The steroid hormones in particular, they change or regulate metabolism, especially in protein synthesis, in a little different way. And so the question becomes, if we use these hormones in meat or, say, in cattle, what effect does it have on human health? And the answer is none. We use some estrogens in our implants. There's a natural one that everybody is familiar with. It's called estradiol 17 beta. That's the estrogen compound that we all are concerned about. And so the question is if we use these implants and we put them in the ear of a cow, does it matter? Well, for one thing, all of them have been tested for years, and that's part of their approval process, is that there is no withdrawal with those implants, which meaning there is no time that you have to give for the implant to wear out, because it's minuscule, the amount that actually goes into the tissue. And so you could put an implant in an animal, and then 10 days later you could eat them, and it really doesn't affect anything. It doesn't change the composition of the meat, or it doesn't increase the hormone level that's circulating in their blood or tissue. It regulates metabolism. And so because of that, there's no withdrawal on any of these implants. We have two different kinds. We have the androgenic or the estrogenic compounds, meaning male and female. And what we do is we put those, are generally both classes are put into the same implant to help regulate that metabolism. Just like every male in the world, every adult male has estrogen that we make every day. But that level is controlled. We also make testosterone every day. Women make estradiol every day. And so all of that, it's the level at which is present in tissue. What difference does it make? So is the question, is if we put an implant in cattle, is that something that we should be concerned about? And the answer is no, because when we implant those, and we talk about, we mentioned it before with antibiotics and stuff, when we start talking about the presence of some of this stuff, we talk about what are called nanograms. Nanograms are 1/1,000,000,000 of a gram, which a penny weighs about a gram. So it's 1/1,000,000,000 of the weight of a penny, or 1/1,000,000,000 of a gram is a nanogram. And so what's really matters with that is estrogenic activity in that. So when we take, for instance, let's compare what a, say, meat from an implanted steer would be. That particular, in 3 ounces of beef of an implanted steer, there's 1.9 nanograms of estrogenic activity, which means the estrogens, estradiol 17 beta, 1.9 parts per billion. In meat that is non-implanted, there's 1.2 nanograms in 3 ounces of beef. So there's a difference of about 0.7 nanograms or 0.7 parts per billion difference between those two. So let's look at some other things. What about if you drank a glass of milk? In a glass of milk, there's about 34 nanograms of estrogenic activity. So 34 parts per billion. But if we looked at some of the other things, because plants have what are called phytoestrogens in them that are about 1,000 times weaker than regular estrogen, but they have a much higher level. So if you, let's say you ate a bowl of split pea soup that has about 900 parts per billion of estrogenic levels. If you eat an egg has 993 parts per billion of estrogenic activity. But let's look at cabbage, for instance. If you ate 4 ounces of cabbage, there would be 2,700 parts per billion of estrogenic activity in that 4 ounce serving of cabbage. So when we stop and think about it, how much was in the beef? What was the difference? It was 0.7 parts per billion. And just so a reference, a low-dose birth control pill has 35,000 nanograms of estrogenic activity in one tablet. Wow. So really, when we look at the amounts of estrogen or estrogenic activity in meat from this, from animals that use this technology, it's negligible in comparison. So the other thing too is that, well, what about people? Do they make estrogen every day? And like I mentioned before, yes, they do. Let's say a pre-puberty girl before she reaches puberty has about 54,000 nanograms of estrogen that she produces every day. 54,000 parts per billion. And we're talking about 0.7 parts per billion?
It seems so silly, doesn't it?
It does. And it's not because people are wrong. It's just that they don't have the right information.
Right.
And that's what we want to do, is we want to make sure that people are informed to realize that this, the hormone discussion in beef is not scientifically based. It's emotionally based. And so when we really apply the scientific knowledge that we have to that, we recognize that this technology is not just safe, it's beneficial for everybody involved. It benefits the rancher because their calves gain a little faster, it takes less feed, it takes less grass, it takes less water. So the natural resource, there is conservation to the natural resources that they use to produce beef. It also, in this process, it's great for the environment. It helps us, but it also helps us produce more beef, more economically, to feed the world. And that's what this is about. So in reality, we need to get the word out about how this technology, the use of growth-promoting implants in beef production, is a beneficial thing, and it's part of our sustainability that we are striving for. And so I think it's a technology that people just don't understand well. And I would encourage, if they're interested in getting more information, I can help them. But there's lots of information out there. The scientific studies by multiple groups have always shown, including groups from all over the world, have studied the implants and realized that there is no health, there is no risk to human health for in ingesting the product that from animals that have been used, this technology has been used in. And I think that's a message that everybody needs to understand.
I do too, because again, if you hit social media or the internet, the Google machine is going to tell you differently.
That is correct.
You know, and so it's hard, and we're just not as close to agriculture as we used to be.
Yeah, you know, less than 2% of the people in the world now are involved in agriculture. And so there's a lot of misinformation, there's a lot of misunderstanding that goes forth. When people were close to the land, they understood a lot more of these types of things. Mm-hmm. But generationally, we have been removed from the land, and that has a profound effect on it. And that's part of it, too. You got to understand that especially our cattle producers are very, very conscious about trying to produce a safe and wholesome product. And they eat it every day. And so mm-hmm. they obviously would not feed something to their family mm-hmm. if there was any kind of health concerns about it. And that's, but neither here nor there. If somebody wonders, really what they should do is go look for the real science. Go look for the actual scientific studies that show this. Mm-hmm. Because there is a multitude of them. Mm-hmm. And it's really difficult for you to find studies that show negative effects at all. Because they're just not really out there. Because even World Health Organizations have studied this for many years and just cannot find a reason to say this is bad.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go this route for you and ask this question, because this is one that you'll find on the internet pretty commonly, is that girls are going into puberty earlier because of the hormones in meat.
And that's just like I showed you, the amount of hormone that's present in meat, and especially for girls, and estradiol, what level that is present in meat is so negligible it has no effect on the puberty. Because obviously, girls, even prepubertal girls, make so much more hormone by their own body every day mm-hmm. that, as we talked about, the numbers were such that 0.7 or even, let's say it's 2, because in a non-implanted animal, there's 1.2 nanograms of estrogenic activity or estrogenic level in that in a 3-ounce portion. Let's just say it's 2 nanograms. They're making 54,000 a day. So it's, and then once they reach puberty, a non-pregnant woman, she's making close to 500,000 parts per billion, 500,000 nanograms of estrogen every day. And so because of that the amount of hormone that they ingest in red meat is just, it is of no consequence whatsoever.
Yeah, and I believe I've read more studies on that actually show there's more of a correlation between young girls going into puberty earlier based on their body fat. So there's more of a correlation there than there is on, eating beef or anything that's been implanted. But I guess it's kind of an oxymoron in a way to say that beef is hormone free, because you were saying a non-implanted steer still has 1.2 parts per billion.
Yeah, that's correct, because hormones are a chemical messenger made by the body that circulate to a tissue and elicit an effect and regulate metabolism. There's hormones circulating in your body all the time, up until the time you die.
Right.
There will be hormones circulating in your body, and that's true with our food-producing animals. Those same hormones are circulating in their body up until the time they are harvested, and therefore, there will be some level present in the tissue. That's just the way nature is. Mm-hmm. But the whole question is the level that in tissue, is it concerning to human health? And the answer is no. It's negligible in that regards. And like I said, it's been studied so much over the years. And all the bodies that condemned it at first, after reviewing the science and doing their own work and all that, have all concluded that hormones are safe. And that's mm-hmm. exactly why there is no withdrawal associated with that technology, because there are no health concerns. It's kind of like with the antibiotics in meat as well. Mm-hmm. Both of these, both antibiotics and hormones, are looked for, and because of the facts that are in the science. If you really look at the science, the meat that we eat is safe, both from a hormone standpoint and from an antibiotic standpoint. Meat is safe.
And it's good.
And it's so healthy. It's so good for you.
Mm-hmm.
And even, it used to be that the concern was, well, it causes heart problems and all that. And all that, that science was fabricated, has been refuted. Mm. And the current studies are now show that red meat is part of a heart-healthy diet. And so it's something that we need to look at the science to say, not the emotional outpourings that are created, but we need to look at science. And what does science tell us? Science tells us red meat is good for us.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. so, you know, it's obviously there's moderation with everything, but I'm not going to moderate. I want to eat as much red meat.
I grew up on a cattle ranch, and so, I really do like a good steak.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And especially it's such high quality, and our producers are striving all the time to make genetic improvements and stuff to make sure that the product that moves forward is of the highest quality that it can be. And it is.
Yeah.
We are so lucky.
Yeah.
To have the producers that we do in this country.
Yeah. And I can say here locally too that we also, you know, we host several different workshops and classes throughout the year, both here in Grant County and throughout the state, you know, the nation. Our producers are really good about, they go to those. They want to stay up to date with, you know, the latest and greatest technologies. They want to make sure that they're, you know, following labels. They're doing all of the right things. And I think that that is something that is also a misconception, that they're just hanging out on the ranches and they never come to town. They never learn anything new. And they're actually all the time learning and striving to make sure that they're doing things the right way.
That's correct. And so I'm also the state coordinator for the New Mexico Beef Quality Assurance Program. And so I get to work with producers a lot in this very arena. And one of the things that I found is that especially producers in New Mexico that I deal with, they are absolutely committed to always reviewing their management techniques to see, is there technologies that I need to incorporate to make me better, to do things differently. And of course, even with what are the things that we can do to make our ranch cows more efficient, to make sure our environmental impact is, and you know, you hear a lot about the carbon cycle and all of this, and there's been quite a bit of recent work done to show that, you know, in reality, when it comes to carbon, that cattle are sequesterers of carbon, and so they're not part of the problem, they're actually part of the solution. And so cattle and how we produce cattle, especially in our big old open ranges like we have, they're part of the sustainability equation.
Mm-hmm.
And our ranchers are aware of that. And so as management practices change and technology and science and research is conducted and we take it to the country and show these ranchers, they're quick to adopt changes that benefit the environment and benefit their production and benefit the animals that are under their care.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are a very progressive group. They're committed to safety and wholesomeness for the beef that they produce. And I think that's a wonderful industry to be associated with.
Me too. Me too. So this was all very educational. I've heard this same presentation a few times, but every single time I pick up more.
Good.
From it. And so I think that this type of information needs to be shouted from the rooftops. I think it needs to be more prevalent. And I really enjoy having someone like you. You know what you're talking about. You're a vet. You've gone through all the school and all the things, and you know what you're talking about, and I'd much rather hear it from you than from the Google machine.
That's correct, and I really appreciate the chance to share the information that I have with you and your listeners, so thank you for the invitation.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you enjoy this podcast, don't forget to hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever app you're using to listen to this podcast. Want more information? You can visit us at our website, grantextension.nmsu.edu. Follow us on Facebook at NMSU Grant County CES, Snapchat at Grant County NM4H, shoot us an email at grant@nmsu.edu, or give us a call, 575-388-1559. Did you enjoy this podcast? Did you learn something? Did you gain knowledge that you can use? please feel free to reach out to me and let me know. I'm always looking for feedback on what I can do better or topics that I can discuss. So please give me an email at grant@nmsu.edu.
New Mexico State University is an equal opportunity, affirmative action employer and educator, NMSU and the U.S. Department of Agriculture cooperating.